Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now. After more than 2 weeks of violent protests in Nepal, the country's king addressed his nation today and promised to return power to the people. King Gyanendra's announcement came after tens of thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators took to the streets again today, calling for an end to his monarchy. Joining us to talk about the king's announcement and whether it'll help end the violence, we turn to Bikas Sangrola. He's a Nepalese journalist reporting for the Christian Science Monitor in Kathmandu. And Bikas, what was the message from the king today?
The king said that he is handing over the power back to the people, and he asked the political parties to form a government soon. Till that time, the present cabinet will continue to function. The king also indirectly referred to the Maoists by asking the groups who have left the constitution to come back to a constitutional process.
So is this what the protesters were seeking? Will this make these demonstrations stop, do you think?
The protesters actually were asking for drafting a new constitution. And in fact, in the last few days, the protesters were even demanding that they will settle for nothing less than a republic. So this is way below the expectation of the masses, but still I can see that outside my office window on the road, there are a lot of people who are in a jubilant mood, but still they are asking that the king quit, the king leave the country.
Mm-hmm. So this is just what they perceive as a first step by the king that's not adequate then?
It is clear that the people will not swallow this as the adequate result of 16 days of protests. So I don't think this will be able to subside the demonstrations. But we are yet to see response from the political parties who have been asked to form a government.
So does the king have support, and from what group might the king have some support?
The king is only supported by the security forces. We have the Royal Nepalese Army, the Nepal Police, and the Armed Police Force. Apart from that, everyone is against the king, doctors, lawyers, even civil servants, bank staff, even employees of government run banks. Even the journalists are protesting, the civil society is protesting.
Can you remind us, Bikas, what set off these demonstrations?
The people of Nepal experienced democratic freedoms from 1990 to October 2002, when the king dismissed an elected parliament. And this is actually the demonstration by people who want those democratic rights back. These demonstrations, while they are supported by the Maoists, it is not a Maoist uprising as such. It has become more like a people's movement than a political demonstration.
Because I'm wondering, can you tell me, these protests have been compared to almost the French Revolution.
I personally think that going by the participation from almost all quarters, almost all sections of the society, is definitely comparable to big revolutions that have taken place in history. And we can see here that even the armed groups, they have left their arms for a while, and they have come to participate in these peaceful protests. So, going by today's announcement, it is clear that the king is not giving up. He is still holding on to power in one way or another. I don't think the announcement of today will be able to subdue the demonstrations, and we might very well see a complete revolution in the days to come.
All right, Bikas, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, welcome.
Bikas Sangrola is reporting for the Christian Science Monitor from Nepal. Oil prices set another record today when the cost per barrel topped $73, and some analysts say they have nowhere to go but up. Concerns about Iran's nuclear ambitions, declining gas stocks in the U.S., and oil supply disruptions in Nigeria are all contributing to this spike and causing energy companies to consider what they call unconventional oil sources. These alternative sources require almost science fiction-like recovery methods, which raise economic and environmental concerns. But as the technology improves and the price of oil continues to climb, companies are bringing these unconventional sources online. One of the new production frontiers is the oil sands of northern Canada. Under this part of the world, companies extract a thick substance called bitumen, basically a rough form of crude oil. Firms are also eyeing an estimated 2 trillion barrels of oil shale, which lies deep under the bedrock of some of the southwestern United States. As expected, getting to these buried commodities is raising concerns among environmentalists who say this oil rush is misguided because it's expensive and because it takes more energy to convert these unconventional sources into usable oil. We will hear from an environmental group about these concerns in just a few minutes. But first, joining us on the line is Stephen Paget. He's a research analyst with First Energy Capital Research in Calgary, Canada. And Stephen, what are these oil sands and how much oil are we talking about?
There are 174 billion barrels of oil sands. That's enough to produce 3 million barrels a day for 174 years. Now, some of it's all located in northeastern Alberta in the boreal forest. That's really a lot of, basically a lot of trees and muskeg, and located near the Athabasca River. Some of the oil is mined using large trucks and shovels from the surface, and much of the oil, too, is extracted using steam pump down the well, and then the oil is brought back up to the top. It's bitumen, so it's very, it needs to be heated, it sticks to the sand, and it either has to be mined from the sand, or, and that's cleaned from the sand, or extracted using the steam. Mm-hmm. It's not like conventional oil.
And so is that expensive to do? What is the cost per barrel to do this?
We're looking at over $20 a barrel to take this bitumen from the sand, whether mined or using steam, and then brought to a state where it's more usable, that is, upgraded into a synthetic crude oil.
Does it take a long time to do this?
It doesn't take that long. There's lots of oil in the system, so there's always more oil coming through, to more bitumen going in and coming out, and the cycle time is probably not all that long, but it takes a very long time to set up these projects, perhaps 6 or 7 years from first conceiving of the project to actually bringing it on stream.
So is oil being produced there right now, and how much are we getting from there?
We're getting 1.1 million barrels of oil a day from our oil sands, both from underground steam injection and from the trucks and shovels that are mining over 600,000 barrels a day of bitumen sand, which is then turned into the synthetic crude oil and shipped across Canada and to the northern United States.
So what is that doing to I'm assuming must have been a very rural wilderness, almost like area of northern Canada?
It was indeed a wilderness, and surface mining is a large and messy business. It takes the topsoil and trees, and that is all removed, and then mining down perhaps almost to 100 or 150 feet, and then the bitumen layer is exposed, scooped up, put into the truck, and taken back to the plant site. And the mining is done over a wide area. Now, we can reclaim mines, that is, fill in the earth and put the topsoil back. It's all carefully set aside to be put back the way it was. We've reclaimed some land already, and we have actually a buffalo herd already grazing on that land.
But I'm wondering, in terms of the town itself, who's coming in there? Which companies are coming in there? And are there a lot of workers there now? And what's happening to the communities that were there?
The community of Fort McMurray basically grew up around with the oil sands. It's an old trading post, and it's grown to about 60,000 people with the influx of both construction workers and operators in the oil sands there. And they have a very low vacancy rate. Essentially, there are no vacancies, and people are paying $500 a month to sleep on couches. The vacancy rate is so low. Getting a hotel room is very difficult.
And what kind of salaries are they making?
Well, they're making over $100,000 a year, whether a welder or a pipe fitter. They need that kind of money because apparently the poverty line there is in the $60,000 Canadian range to be able to afford rent, food, etc.
Mm-hmm. So then why has there been such growth right now, do you think?
For a long time, Canadian producers were able to serve the needs of Canadian and American consumers largely through conventional oil production. And that production began to decline relatively steeply in the late 1990s. And that's when the third oil sands project, Shell, that owned by Shell Canada and Chevron and Western, was constructed. And because just simply to keep meeting the needs of customers we already have, we've got to keep bringing on more oil sands projects.
Why are they just in this part of Canada, these oil sands? Do you know?
It's just geologic luck that there happened to be a massive amount of sand in ancient river deltas, beaches, estuaries, the sort of things made by rivers and ocean shores, and that there was a second region that produced a lot of oil. The oil moved into the sand there, and by a fluke of geology, a 174 billion barrel resource is sitting up in northern Alberta. Now, to put that into perspective, that's only slightly smaller than Saudi Arabia, but it is a little harder to extract.
Stephen Padgett is an oil industry research analyst with First Energy Capital Research in Calgary, Canada. We're going to continue our conversation with him in a moment, but before we take a break, we want to check in on what's happening at the pumps, where people are feeling the effects of the higher oil prices. The average cost of a gallon of gas right now is at about $2.85.
What are you going to do, stay home? There's no other way. You'll have to use it. Unless they give you alternatives, and about time they will give us alternatives.
I think it's a disgrace that our country hasn't figured out a way to use alternative energy sources so that we're not so dependent on foreign countries.
I still got to get to work and go where I got to go, so I just pay the gas. Two or three less beers, that's all.
Drivers in areas around New York City and Philadelphia, they're facing another problem as well. Pumps are actually running dry. Liberty Petroleum officials say four of the 40 stations it supplies in the Philadelphia region ran out of fuel in the last 2 days. The problem is a switch in fuel types. Federal law says refiners have to switch to fuel formulations containing corn-based ethanol because of concerns about the previous gas additive known as MTBE. To make the switch, retailers have to clean their tanks, remove all water, and install new filters on their pumps. Terminals have to clean storage tanks, too, and that means empty tanks for a while. These shortages promise to get worse as the summer driving season approaches. When we come back, we'll hear an environmentalist who says despite the high cost of oil, it's not worth going to these oil sands of Canada to try to increase supply. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Young, it's here and now. We're continuing our conversation about the growing interest in what's called unconventional oil, mainly the oil sands of northern Canada and oil shale buried under the southwestern United States. Stephen Padgett is a research analyst with First Energy Capital Research in Calgary, Canada. And Stephen, you were saying before the break that oil sands hold nearly as much oil as in all of Saudi Arabia. Now, put that in perspective in terms of cost for us. If oil sands cost $20 a barrel to produce, and traditional oil was selling today at a record $73.50 a barrel, how much does this cost to produce, and how should we compare the cost on the oil market?
Well, traditional oil operating costs are under $10. However, the economic advantage that oil sands producers have is everyone knows where the oil sands are, and the capital cost on a per barrel basis, building a plant costs a lot of money, but there is very little reinvestment risk. these companies can build a plant and know that their production will stay the same for 30 years.
And one analyst has said that the price is so high because there's so much investor money flowing into the industry. Do you agree with that?
Well, we see that oil prices are high, largely based on fundamentals of supply and demand, and not so much the money going into the industry. And a company like ExxonMobil is actually putting more money into buying back its own shares than it is into finding and producing oil on the ground. So it sees more value in creating that value for its shareholders than trying to find oil at these prices.
So do you think then that consumer reaction to high prices would affect anything?
It does. We, a fellow I know named Peter Terzakian wrote a book called The 1,000 Barrels a Second. He talks about break points where consumers and businesses and industry together change their habits and make do with less oil. That is economic growth requires less energy to accomplish. And this happened in the early 70s, the first major oil crisis, and he believes that it can happen again, that habits will change, and it really depends on what the crude price is to get there. I'm seeing a lot of smaller cars come on the market these days, so that might imply the beginning of a change.
I heard one analyst say that if everyone in America decided to drive 3% less in the next 30 days, that oil prices would crash.
Well, that's a good analogy. What he's really saying is one out of every 30 days, and people will do this based on economics. People in the United States, a point might be, say, at $4 a gallon. Now, prices in Canada, in Canadian dollars, are actually at $4 a gallon. And that's a bit of a psychological barrier. So difficult to crash the price of oil by consumer behavior, possible to change it, yes.
And what about if we go back to the oil sands? Will they make a change at all here?
The oil sands production capacity growth is high and could be another 1.8 million barrels a day by 2015. And will that change the situation? It will continue to feed what has been put out as a growth scenario for Canada and the United States, but higher prices could change that growth. The question is, where would the oil sands crude go? It could go to China, for example. And you asked about the environmental issues.
Right. Well, I'd also like you to just talk about the environmental issues. I know that some environmental groups are concerned, particularly about the carbon dioxide emissions from this type of oil recovery. Can you talk about that?
First issue seems to be the mining itself. And companies are working on developing technologies that make the mining less intrusive and much faster to reclaim. Second, more of the oil is going to be extracted using steam from underground, and this is much less intrusive than mining, but most importantly, carbon dioxide. The oil sands produce a lot of carbon dioxide. Now, carbon dioxide might have a commercial use by bringing it from Fort McMurray, northeast Alberta, down to our conventional oil fields. That carbon dioxide goes in the ground, pushes more conventional oil out. And the question on an economic perspective is, who will economically benefit? Companies are definitely looking at taking this CO2 and reinjecting it. And there's an economic incentive right now to do so.
Stephen Padgett is an oil industry research analyst with First Energy Capital Research in Calgary, Canada. We turn now to Dan Lashoff. He's senior scientist watching the oil industry at the National Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, Deborah.
We are talking about unconventional oil sources, specifically these oil sands in northern Canada. Do you think that this is a way to go and something that we should be looking at right now, particularly because of the high price of oil?
Well, Deborah, there's no question that we have got to break our dependence on conventional sources of oil, but we have a fundamental choice to make. We can either go towards these kinds of unconventional resources, such as oil sands and producing synthetic fuels from coal, which many people in the U.S. are beginning to talk about, which would commit us to greater levels of environmental disruption, both from mining and from heat-trapping carbon dioxide pollution put into the atmosphere. Or we can go in a different direction, which I think is both economically and environmentally superior, and that is to break our dependence on oil by becoming, first, much more efficient in how we use every barrel of oil that is produced, and by developing cleaner substitutes such as biofuels, such as moving to electricity in some applications if we produce our electricity with clean sources of energy. And that really is a critical choice, and I think that the oil sands development really moves us fundamentally in the wrong direction.
Dan Lashoff is a scientist watching the oil industry at the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. Monday on Here and Now, Enron founder Ken Lay follows former CEO Jeffrey Skilling to the witness stand in their fraud and conspiracy trial in Houston. Also, two Muslims talk about how moderates have to speak out against terrorism. That's next week. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
It's Here and Now. In Iraq today, Shiite leaders put forth a new name for prime minister in an attempt to break months of deadlock over the country's new government. But they nominated a top ally of outgoing Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri. In a surprise move yesterday, al-Jafri suddenly stepped aside following weeks of sharp opposition from Sunni and Kurdish leaders. With a unique perspective on Iraq, one American soldier is looking back on his time there with an eye to the future. Here and Now listeners may remember Sergeant Terry Blogg, a professional soldier and elite Army Ranger who is also a professional ballet dancer with Columbia City Ballet in South Carolina. We spoke with him when he was deployed in Iraq last June. Sergeant Blogg is now back in the States, and despite being away from ballet for a year, he'll perform the lead in the Ballet Capella in the Boston area this weekend with his girlfriend, dancer Miranda Bailey. Both are new to leading roles. To the characters they play, the happy-go-lucky lovers Franz and Swanilda, and Terry learned his steps for the ballet in Iraq via DVD. Here and Now's Lynn Menegon sat down with Terry and Miranda in Concord, Massachusetts before a recent rehearsal and asked them, are they ready for their debut?
I will admit I'm nervous going into this, but I feel pretty ready. I think the run-throughs have been going really well.
I do not feel so confident as her. It's been a long time since I've danced, and it's coming back slower than I would have liked. I was in good shape because there were really no distractors. I mean, you were either doing a mission or you were in the gym or you were asleep. But dancing-wise, no.
So you didn't actually get a chance to physically practice the steps?
No, there was no space. In fact, I could barely even stretch, not in the way that a dancer needs to stretch. It was impossible. And believe me, I tried. This actually is a lot more stressful and makes me a lot more apprehensive than anything I've done over in Iraq.
How so?
I'm not going to get killed doing this, so I would have to live with the shame of a bad performance. If I get blown up in Iraq, no one's going to say, oh, you know, I won't be around to hear people make fun of me, so it's no big deal. They'll just do a nice little memorial and that'll be the end of it.
I'm sure there's some people in the audience, the radio audience, going,
It's true. You know, the Army stuff, that's just work. I mean, there were, you know, obviously several times that things were, you know, a little hairy over there. But mostly I was just looking after my guys, and I was more worried about myself making a mistake that would get somebody else killed. And I was just worried about completing the missions and getting my guys home safe. And, you know, a year of pretty much staying on alert, I guess, eventually wears you down. And I think it was just a big stress let off. I got pretty sick for a couple weeks immediately after, you know, like when I finally unloaded all my bags and just kind of sat down. It's like I think my body just kind of collapsed and I got sick for a couple weeks and, you know, finally snapped out of it. But But I think I was more mentally tired than anything. There's no such thing as an empty street or an empty building over there. There's always eyes on you. And that's why every time you roll out the gate, you have to do it right.
You kind of have two roles. You're a soldier and a dancer. Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile them, or do they need to be reconciled?
They used to need to be reconciled, but not anymore. The things about me as a soldier, I bring into my dancing. Like as a dancer, when I see the rest of the company complaining about one issue or another, I feel a little bit ashamed sometimes and think, you know, my God, quit being such a bunch of babies. You know, it could be a lot worse. You know, that's the soldier in me coming out. Like even doing a show like this, it's a privilege and it's a luxury to be able to do this type of thing. And if you don't have people out there fighting the bad guys and hunting the bad guys, then these privileges will end.
Would you rather be on stage as a dancer or fighting as a soldier?
Well, the Army pays better, believe it or not. So that's, and especially combat tours, that's good money. And I don't know. If I knew which one I liked better, I wouldn't continue to try and do both. You know, people say, well, pick one and do one. Well, it's not that easy. Now, I feel obligations morally and socially to continue on with my Army work. There's still a lot of threats out there. Still a lot of bad people in the world. And it's not going to go away in my lifetime, I don't think. And that's just the life we lead. And so I'll dance whenever I can, and when it's time for me to go away and do some more, then I'll do that.
Why does ballet matter to you? Some people ask, why does ballet matter?
I think I can tell you why dance is important in one word: escape. Especially at a time when we're a country at war, it's important to have methods of escape. I mean, Capella was first created during the Franco-Prussian War as a lighthearted escape of the horrible things that were going to come, and all of the lead characters from the original Capella died in the siege on Paris. So I think Franz lived.
I think Franz lived,
but it's an important ballet to do because of that, because it meant an awful lot to a lot of people when they first created it, and that's why it's held up for 200 years.
You know, this is, you know, I'm not able to dance full time anymore, and so this is what I do on my off time, and so this I put a lot more work into because I don't have to do it, and so it's something I want to do.
So what does it take to have longevity in both the Army and ballet?
A will to win. Heart. It's that simple.
Do you want to go back to Iraq? Are you afraid to go back to Iraq?
No, I do not want to go back to Iraq. Because it was hot and smelly, flies. The worst part about going to Iraq is not getting killed. It's saying goodbye to my loved ones. That's the hard part. And I'm just glad to be home.
There's not enough time to get it off stage. It depends who the people that are coming in before us are going.
Okay.
Curtain call.
Two, three, four.
Dancer and Army Sergeant Terry Blogg and ballerina Marinda Bailey about playing Capella. For more information, go to our website here-now.org.
Don't go behind her. Next rope.
Still to come, a celebration of the life and music of Arthur Lannan, the man who directed the Masterworks Choral for decades. You're listening to Here and Now.
7, 8, go. 1, Clarissa, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Marina. 4, 5, 6, 7. Go.
New Orleans voters go to the polls tomorrow for the city's first municipal election since Hurricane Katrina flooded 80% of the city and forced about 250,000 people from their homes. The mayor's race is getting nationwide attention as incumbent Ray Nagin fights for his political life in a city where not only the landscape but the racial composition has changed dramatically since he took office. With about two dozen candidates, it's likely there will be a runoff for the mayor's seat between the two top vote-getters next month. Joining us on the line from New Orleans with more on the mayor's race and what it means for the city is Adam Nossiter of the New York Times. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you very much.
23 people running for mayor in this election. Who are the top contenders here?
Well, there are really only three who have a shot at getting into the runoff. One of them, of course, is the incumbent, Ray Nagin. The one who is closest to him in the polls is the Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu, and then running behind both of them is a businessman who lives in uptown New Orleans, Ron Foreman.
Incumbent Mayor Nagin was widely criticized after Katrina. He also made controversial comments shortly afterwards, saying that New Orleans was going to be a chocolate city again, referring to the fact that many African Americans still have not returned there. What's this campaign been like, particularly among these three top contenders?
Well, the campaign has been strangely muted because none of the three have really addressed what has to be the central issue facing New Orleans right now, which is which neighborhoods are going to be rebuilt and which neighborhoods are going to have to be abandoned. It's just too sensitive a subject, apparently, they feel, to be confronted head-on. It is fraught with racial and social and political implications, and so it really hasn't been addressed. The candidates have been dancing around that central issue and talking about what strike many people here as marginal topics, and meanwhile the sort of underlying dynamic of the whole thing has got to be race, as it so often is in Louisiana elections. Will white voters simply vote for the white candidates? Will black voters gravitate only around the incumbent mayor, Ray Nagin?
And how has the racial composition of the city changed?
Well, no one really knows for sure. The best guesses, it seems to me, put the racial composition of the city at about 50-50, which would, of course, be a dramatic change from the past when blacks made up almost 70% of the population. But it's a great unknown, and it's one of the things, I think, that will be revealed in Saturday's vote, that is, the demographics of this new Orleans.
There's also the problem of so many people still displaced, and this has posed quite a logistical nightmare for these elections to even be happening.
That's right. No one really knows who's going to be voting on Saturday, how many people, and the state has made some effort to accommodate the thousands of New Orleans citizens who are still in exile, as it were. The state set up satellite voting centers in 10 places around the state, some of which are accessible, for instance, to Texas, where many New Orleans residents have been. And those have been open for 2 weeks now. But everyone has been quite surprised by how few of these displaced citizens have actually taken advantage of the opportunity to vote in satellite voting centers. So that could mean either that those people who are still displaced from New Orleans have given up on politics in the city and are not interested, or it could also mean that many more people have returned to the New Orleans area than was previously thought. We simply don't know.
Hmm. So it's a very strange election, it sounds like. You've been there for 15 years, Adam. What's the strangest thing you've seen?
Well, the strangest thing one continues to see here, I think, is the sort of absence of people. There is a feeling that this city is depopulated. You can ride down the Central Avenue uptown, for instance, at night and not cross a single car. It is very clear, it seems to me, that many, many people are still missing from this city.
Well, Adam, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Adam Nossiter of the New York Times. He spoke with us from New Orleans. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and now. now. Noted choral conductor Alan Lanham died recently at the age of 88. For 52 years, Alan led the Masterworks Chorale here in Massachusetts, perhaps the longest tenure of a local music director. He also taught hundreds of future chorale directors for 3 decades at Boston University and another 2 decades at the Boston Conservatory. Alan Lanham laid down his baton only last year, and at that time, Robin Young visited with him as he prepared for retirement and began rehearsals for a final series of concerts.
The purpose of this rehearsal is to try and get them to phrase a sense of working with afterbeat phrasing.
What does that mean, afterbeat phrasing?
Well, usually you think of 1, 2, 3, and 4, and the way Bach writes it's 1-da-da-da-dee-pee-dee-dee-dee-pa-da-da-da. He leaves the beat and goes to the next beat. And so on and so forth.
This must give the impression of being totally
emotionally out of control, but not being that. And it must have that kind of exhilaration. It's a gorgeous figure that he uses there anyway. Sicuteherati, not sicuteherati, sicuteherati. And one.
A consummate teacher as well as conductor, Alan taught at Boston University for 3 decades and has probably led these pieces over a dozen times. But he approached this rehearsal as if it was his first. In fact, this would mark the beginning of Alan's last season as full-time conductor of Masterworks. When we spoke, he had just announced his retirement. So we decided to bring you once again our visit with Alan Lanham as he prepares for a concert and reflects on a life immersed in the masterpieces as conductor of Masterworks.
One of the greatest I ever had a chance to conduct was the Beethoven Missa Solemnis. Of course, we're doing the Brahms, and that is moving in a different kind of way.
Well, and then, of course, there's the crowd pleaser, Carmina Burana.
Yes,
Yahoo!
Carmina Burana, yeah.
Lanham began years ago conducting church choirs, and early on he served as assistant to legendary conductor Robert Shaw.
When you see him work, you see what he does. At one time he was trying to get the women's section to be a little bit more expressive in their singing, and he said to them, he says, you won't give yourself maybe totally to love, but at least you must be capable of it. And he got his point across.
I've heard you do things like that as well, you know, so try to paint an emotional image that you want the singers to translate into their voice.
I think we all do it, just try and get people to feel and understand what it is that you're singing about.
Now, with a little exuberance for, you know, for what you're doing, it so sounds so, what's the word, celibate?
It's a lot of work.
Yes. It is hard work. Years ago, it might have been a real athletic experience.
I don't know. It still seemed pretty athletic this time. I mean, watching you, your arms waving around, you'd be right down on the floor, right in front of the sections, and almost, you know, pulling with your arms, trying to pull their sound out.
Well, that's what you're trying to do. I find if I'm right in their faces sometimes, as I sometimes will say, oh, there's a little bit of a problem there, wasn't there, sopranos? And so let's do it again. And I go down and stand right in front of them. The problem disappears.
Yes, sir. Right in front of them.
Yeah.
The day of the concert, the chorale members mingle in the basement of Sanders Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, alongside professional soloists and orchestra members hired out of Masterworks' small budget. An assistant does a final warm-up.
Right, not used to this, right? Let's try it again. Right, very good.
Before last words from Alan.
I was thinking as I was sitting in there and listening to people warm up, what a wonderful thing it is to sing. I want to see you enjoying it, not just hearing you enjoy it. I want to see you enjoy it. Okay? Are you excited about doing this concert?
Yes.
Good. Well, you should be. I love to hear amateurs sing and see how that sound can change and how that understanding can change. That's what it's all about. Sometimes when I listen to tapes of our concerts, and I say, you know, they really sound pretty good.
There's something that happens. It's almost as if you're like you become like a human tuning fork when you hit it just right. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The overtones begin to be shared by everybody, and when it really comes into tune and you can sense it, it is a very, very satisfying thing. Yeah? It just is a kind of a spine-tingling kind of thing when you have the sound that speaks like that.
Fabulous.
Thank you so much.
What a great piece.
The most important thing to me is to see the expression of the people, the singers, after the concert.
I love that piece.
Yeah.
I think it was the first year I came to sing with the chorus we did that song.
Is that right?
Did you do that 30 years ago?
Yes,
the same Bach Magnificat. I was in the chorus.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great.
How are you feeling about, approaching some of the last concerts?
Well, it's a little difficult for me to talk about it because the whole experience has meant so much to me. I've had opportunities to go other places and do other things, but the Masterworks Chorale was the unit that kept pulling me back here.
I just have to tell you, my son is enjoying working with you so much. And
thank you so much.
Fabulous. We love
thank
coming
you so
to
much.
These guys.
Thank you.
I don't let myself think too much about it. I know I'm going to miss it, no question about that. I've had a full life and a long one in music, and I can't complain.
Just wonderful performance tonight.
Thank you so much.
Conductor Alan Lanham, who died recently at the age of 88. For more on his life and this weekend's memorial in honor of it, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now's Robin Young remembering the life of conductor Alan Lanham. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Robin will be back Monday. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker.